We, I think, as human beings, are pretty good about looking at people, having a quick encounter, and just forming first impressions. Now, what we form is not always charitable, but we're good at doing this. We witness one behavior, we hear one sentence, and we know everything about that person, we think. I think you do this when you're driving. You know you do. I do it. Somebody that you don't even know and have never met, they veer into your lane, or they pause too long at a green light before taking off, or they drive too slowly when you're trying to go somewhere, and you've got a whole story about this person. You give them a voice too, don't you? I know you do. I do it. We all do it. Well, looks like Grandpa's decided to take a Sunday stroll down Central Expressway. We form judgments about people based on those moments. We don't know anything about them, but we have them figured out, right? Someone sends you an email, and it's just a one-word reply, no punctuation. It just says, sure. And you think, this is the coldest person ever. What's behind this? I can't believe they would say this. Now, I think for our youth group members, it would be someone sends you a text with punctuation. And you're like, oh, no, like somebody's mad at me. They put an exclamation point in it. I don't know. Why would they do that? They've made me terribly nervous. Right. Someone doesn't say enough, and they're too cold. Someone cuts you off. They're reckless. Someone lingers too long at a green light. They're clueless. Someone drives too slowly in the left lane. Clearly a terrible person. We have moments where we know nothing about a person, witness a few things, and come to whole conclusions about them, about what kind of person they are, and what they must be like in the rest of their life, and really even what they do or don't deserve from me or anyone else in those moments. We've been looking through the book of Jonah in this series called Strange Mercy. And our hero, if we want to call him that, Jonah, has decided for himself what the people of Nineveh do and do not deserve. Now, when we last left our hero at the end of chapter 3, he was, we might call him dumbfounded. He'd preached a 5-word sermon, if you can even call it that, predicting the demise of Nineveh, that wicked, violent, pagan city. And then the people just up and repented out of nowhere with no prompting. Jonah gave minimal effort, and basically he started a widespread revival. And the chapter ended with God saying, I'll spare Nineveh after all. How would you feel about that? Proud? Confused? Relieved? How does Jonah feel? Chapter 4, verse 1. But to Jonah, this seemed very wrong, and he became angry. Well, that's not what you'd hope. That's not how you would expect a prophet to behave. Why is Jonah like this? Why does he resist his mission? Why does he resist God's actions so much? I want to skip to the end of the chapter and the end of the whole book of Jonah. In chapter 4, verse 11, God says, should I not have concern for the great city of Nineveh, in which there are more than 120,000 people who cannot tell their right hand from their left, and also many animals? That's how the book ends. And Jonah must hear that and think, well, see, this is the problem all along. Wait, God, your reason for showing mercy is just that there's a lot of people who aren't that bright and a bunch of animals? How do you feel about God's reasoning? Right? A lot of them, they don't know their right hand from their left, and there are animals. That's the reason. And Jonah must hear that and think, that's not a reason. And maybe that's why Jonah has never wanted to go on this mission. He went west instead of east. He went down instead of up. He went and took a nap on a boat instead of going to preach to the people to whom God called him. And now we can sort of see why. God doesn't say, shouldn't I have mercy on the great city of Nineveh, in which there are many good-hearted people who just need a helping hand? Or the great city of Nineveh, in which there are many searchers looking for direction in their life. It's just, there are many of them, they're not that bright, and there's some cattle. I don't know. I kind of agree with Jonah here. I agree that the Ninevites have nothing redeeming about them. I agree that they're really not worth preaching to. I agree that they don't deserve mercy. But the problem for me is that God doesn't agree. Back in verse 4, after Jonah has expressed his anger, God says to him, "Is it right for you to be angry?" And God's not asking like a non-judgmental therapist who's there just to help you get your feelings out. There's an edge to this question. You can feel it. And God says, your response doesn't match your circumstance. And I don't think you have a right to feel that way. Jonah doesn't answer the question. Instead, he just goes out east of the city, makes himself a shelter, grabs some popcorn, and wait to see what will happen to the city. He's not like those softies, Abraham and Moses, who argued with God to persuade him to spare large groups of people. No, not Jonah. He argues for the opposite, and he still thinks it might happen. Yeah, at the end of the last chapter, God had relented and said he wouldn't punish the city, but Jonah thinks, who knows? Maybe God might change his mind and bring destruction. Jonah holds on to new possibilities from God. In the meantime, as he's sitting east of the city, verse 6, the Lord God provided a leafy plant and made it grow up over Jonah to give shade for his head to ease his discomfort. And Jonah was very happy about the plant. Look at how quickly Jonah's anger disappears just with some shade. Mood and temperature do tend to be related. I remember my years working in the service department of the car dealership where my dad worked. And I remember people would come in. They lived in Texas. It was August, and they owned a black car. And they would come in not in the best of moods about the heat they were feeling in their car, wondering what was wrong with their AC. They weren't the most pleasant customers to deal with, and it became less pleasant when we would put the thermometer on their air vents, showing them that it was blowing cold air. And they would say, "What is the problem then?" To which we would say, "You live in Texas, it's August, and you bought a black car. That's just how this works." We just knew ahead of time AC problems in the summer were not going to lead to the most pleasant customers. They're not in the best of moods. All it takes for Jonah is a plant with some extra shade, I guess beyond his shelter, and he's happy again. And notice in the story how his emotions just seem to ping pong back and forth. Verse 7, at dawn the next day, God provided a worm which chewed the plant so that it withered. When the sun rose, God provided a scorching east wind, and the sun blazed on Jonah's head so that he grew faint. He wanted to die and said, "It would be better for me to die than to live." I think God is just sort of messing with Jonah here. Plant one day, worm the next. Here's some a scorching wind to go with your brutal heat. Jonah, who is just very happy, now once again asks to die. But God doesn't grant that wish. Instead, God asks a familiar question. Is it right for you to be angry about the plant? Now, last time God asked this question, is it right for you to be angry? Jonah didn't give an answer. But now he does. And he says, it is. And I'm so angry, I wish I were dead. Jonah just doubles down on his pouting and once again wishes for death. You would think there might be a self-aware moment in this story where Jonah goes, yeah, fair point, maybe I'm overreacting a little bit. But not here. And so God calls him out. He says, you've been concerned about this plant, though you didn't tend it or make it grow. It sprang up overnight and died overnight. And then here's that final verse that we read earlier. God says, should I not have concern for the great city of Nineveh, in which there are more than 120,000 people who cannot tell their right hand from their left, and also many animals? God says, you're more worried about the plant than the people of Nineveh. And it's hard to argue with that logic. But the problem for us is this: when it comes to mercy and how we view others, we're often not thinking very logically. About 50 years ago, social psychologists began to tell us about something called fundamental attribution error. Put simply, it means we assume the worst about other people and think their problems are a character flaw, and we give ourselves the benefit of the doubt, and we think it's all just about circumstances we had nothing to do with. It's basically the thought that when you mess up, that's who you are. And when I mess up, well, I've got reasons for that. When you speed, it's because you're a reckless driver and someone should pull you over and give you a ticket. When I speed, I've got somewhere important to be and the cops should leave me alone. You have a plank in your eye and that's because you were reckless. I have a speck in my eye and that was just there by accident. That's Jonah. Jonah looks at Nineveh and he says, that's who they are. And then he reviews his last few days with fishes and plants and near-death experiences. And he thinks, well, that's just how things happen to me. That's some bad luck. That is fundamental attribution error happening in real life. We're not thinking straight. We're not being logical. And so maybe, when it comes to mercy, maybe the answer is we just need to think more clearly and be more rational. Except, I'm not sure that God's mercy is rational. God's mercy says, leave the 99 sheep and go after the one who is lost. God's mercy says, pay the workers who showed up after lunch a full day's wages. It says, throw a party when your rebellious, money-squandering, ungrateful grown child finally comes home. And in those stories, the issue is not just that one wandering sheep or workers who showed up late, or the one prodigal son. It's not just that those people needed mercy. It's that the 99 sheep, the workers who showed up at sunrise, the older brother who did everything right, they all needed mercy too. Nineveh, the great, big, wicked city, needed God's mercy. And that mercy showed up in God's mind changing and sparing the city from destruction. Jonah, the person of God, the prophet who should have known better, needed God's mercy too. And for him, that mercy showed up in a plant that provided shade and a big fish that rescued him from drowning at sea. In the midst of all this back and forth and plants sprouting and dying, we get a glimpse of the real Jonah. Not just his actions, but his heart. Most of his objections in this story are made on foot. He moves away and does not do what he's asked. But here we get a verbal objection, and it's real. Jonah is talking to God, and he says these words. "Isn't this what I said, Lord, when I was still at home? I know that you are a gracious and compassionate God, slow to anger and abounding in love, a God who relents from sending calamity. Now, Lord, take away my life, for it is better for me to die than to live." Jonah knows that God is merciful, and he resents it. Or at least he resents it being shown to the Ninevites, people who ought to get what's coming to them, people who don't deserve that mercy. The problem for Jonah, the problem for us is this. Deserve and mercy don't really go together. We're used to looking at people and circumstances and finding reasons to show mercy. At a sentencing hearing, we talk about mitigating circumstances. Why should this person receive a more lenient sentence? And we give reasons for that. Or we're deciding where we want to give some money, and we need to know enough backstory where we can decide, well, does this person deserve some mercy or not? And I get all that. That's normal behavior. But the more and more I learn about God's mercy, I don't think deserving really has anything to do with it. Because over and over again in Scripture, people are shown mercy who didn't do anything to, quote unquote, deserve it. And if we're honest about ourselves, we know that we have been shown mercy after mercy when we didn't deserve it. Whether we were the son who ran away from home or the one who did everything right. In the end, it's just not about deserving God's mercy. At the end of his novel, Brighton Rock, Graham Greene tells about a young woman who's grieving the death of her husband, who is a murderer. And she wonders if, somehow, he found forgiveness before he died. And a priest says to her this quote that was, in fact, the inspiration for how I titled this series. He says, "You cannot conceive, nor can I, of the appalling strangeness of the mercy of God." We can't conceive of its strangeness, of the way it's shown to the undeserving, of the way unequal people are treated equally, of the way God refuses to draw lines that we draw. And that's Jonah's problem. But it is also his salvation. The miracle isn't just that God shows mercy to people who don't know they need it. The miracle is also that he shows mercy to people who don't think they need it. So the one who ran the opposite direction and resented his own success, the one who pouted when God's mercy won, still received shade from a plant God grew, still received rescue from a fish God sent. Tim Keller says that at the end of this story, God shoots an arrow straight for Jonah. But Jonah steps out of the way. And we realize the whole time the arrow has been meant for us. The book ends with this question: should I not have concern for the city? The question isn't answered, which means it's open-ended. Should I not show mercy? What do you think? Let's stand and sing.